Years ago, I was riding around in a pickup truck with a guy at our church. He looked at me with all sincerity and he said, "Do you study for these sermons or do they just come to you?" God was gracious and I didn't kill him. I wanted to. And I looked at him and I said, "I study for these things. They just come to me, you know." Well, my normal way of doing a sermon is a Monday and Tuesday, I'll study. I'll look at the text. I'll read books. I'll read commentaries. I'll do word studies, try to figure out what the meaning is. And then Wednesday and Thursday, I'm thinking, okay, this is what it means, but how do I apply it? How do I make it make sense? How do I make it connect with the people? And that's really, that's the hard work, you know. Figuring out what it says doesn't take you long. Figuring out what to do with it is not. And then by, you know, Thursday or Friday, I'll dictate it. My secretary types it for me. So I have Saturday to, you know, look at it and Saturday evening to go over it. And God gave me a story from the Bible 2 weeks ago that He said, "This is what I want you to preach on." I sensed it, and I have you know, wrestled with that. I call friends in. Okay, how do I apply this? And last night about 10:30, it finally came together. So this is, I'm not sure if I'm lazy or Satan doesn't want it, or this is my swan song before my sabbatical. I don't know what this is, but Matthew chapter 7 is the text, and then I'm going to tell you a story, and then we're going to look at the text. By the way, everybody says, "What are you doing on your sabbatical?" And I'm going to go see the Seattle team for a week, see my son probably, renew some acquaintances, visit some churches, something I don't get to do very often. They don't let me do that. So see what God's doing in other places. But my father-in-law arranged for my wife and I to have a timeshare north of Seattle in the mountains, a place called Glacier. And on the weekends, we're going to see the Seattle team. During the week, we're going to be up in the mountains, the two of us. And my dear dad said to me, "There's only one problem. The timeshares don't have a TV or a phone. And your cell phone won't work in the mountains." I'm like, "Dad, I got a beautiful woman in the cabin. No phone, no TV. That's a problem. You know? Believe me, I'll be fine." So anyways, we're gonna have fun together and enjoy each other in the Lord, and hopefully encourage the Seattle team by just being there with them. So, wonderful time. Don't call. Cell phone won't work. Matthew chapter 7. This is the conclusion of the Sermon on the Mount. This is the it's kind of a capstone on this wonderful sermon. We'll begin reading in verse 15. Where Jesus says, "Beware of false prophets who come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly they are ravenous wolves. You will know them by their fruits. Do men gather grapes from thorn bushes or figs from thistles? Even so, every good tree bears good fruit, but the bad tree bears bad fruit. A good tree cannot bear bad fruit, nor can a bad tree bear good fruit. Every tree that does not bear good fruit is cut down and thrown into the fire. Therefore, by your fruits you will know them. Not everyone who says to me, 'Lord, Lord,' shall enter the kingdom of heaven, but he who does the will of my Father in heaven. Many will say to me in that day, 'Lord, Lord, have we not prophesied in your name and cast out demons in your name and done many wonderful things in your name?' And I will declare unto them, 'I never knew you. Depart from me, you who practice lawlessness.' Therefore, whoever hears these sayings of mine and does them, I will liken him to a wise man who built his house on the rock, and the rain descends, and the floods came, and the winds blew, and beat on that house, and it did not fail, for it was founded on the rock. But everyone who hears these things of mine and does not do them will be likened to a foolish man who built his house on a sand, and the rain descended, and the floods came, and the winds blew, and beat on that house, and it fell, and great was its fall." And so it was that when Jesus had ended these sayings, the people were astonished at his teaching, for he taught them as one having authority and not as the scribes. This is the word of the Lord. They were astonished. He taught as one having authority, not as the religious leaders of his day. And the question is, why are they astonished and we're not? And what in the world was it they were astonished about? To answer that, let me give you a story, and I'll tie this story back to this passage. The story is a story about a king named Joash. It's found in Chronicles 23 and 24, and this king was a baby. His father was wicked and did wicked things, and he was killed in battle. And when he was killed in battle, the queen mother, a woman named Athaliah, who had actually been the daughter of one of the son, the kings of Israel, the northern kingdom, she decides she wants to be the new ruler, and so she starts killing her grandkids. Got to get rid of the heirs to take over the... You know, you thought your grandma was bad? Go hug your grandma. Grandma, you are wonderful. Well, queen mother is killing off the heirs, and the sister of the king grabs this little baby named Joash and hurries out of the palace and goes to the temple because her husband is the high priest. His name is Jehoiada. And she hides the baby, and Jehoiada raises this baby, the heir to the throne, in the temple. And when the child is 7 years old, Jehoiada calls the captains of the army and he says to them, "Look, I have the heir to the throne." And they swear allegiance to this child. And on a given day, they bring the army, surround the temple, and they blow the trumpets, and they bring out Joash, and they declare him king. And the people come, and they rejoice that there's a child of the king alive. And, of course, Athaliah comes out and screams treason. And they cut off her head, you know, outside the gates, and they put this child on the throne. And Joash, he is the new king. And this is what the Bible says, or the writer of Chronicles says about Joash. It says this, and Joash, hang on a second. And Joash was 7 years old when he became king, and he reigned 40 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Zibiah of Beersheba. And Joash did that which was right in the sight of the Lord all the days of Jehoiada the priest. Does that bother you? Joash did right all the days of Jehoiada the priest. Did that kind of make you a little nervous? Well, you read on, and this little boy, this boy king, goes to the Levites, and the first thing he does is he says, "Look, the house of the Lord is in shambles. We need to rebuild the house of God, and we need to restore the worship." Well, that's good. I like that. Well, the Levites, they dilly-dally around, and so he gets upset. This little boy king, he calls in Jehoiada, and he says, "Look, what is wrong with these people? The house of God needs to be rebuilt. You make this box, this chest, and you take it throughout the kingdom, and you declare to the people to give to God, we've got to rebuild the house of God." And so they do this, and there's an urgency, and people give money and gold and jewels, and they bring the money to the temple, and they hire laborers, and they rebuild the temple, and there's stuff left over, so they make vessels of, you know, forks and plates of gold for the house of God, and they declare this wonderful day, and they come, and they blow trumpets, and they sacrifice, and this is the footnote. "And the offering of burnt offerings in the house of the Lord continued all the days of Jehoiada." There is again a little statement that makes you kind of go, if I like that or not. Well, sure enough, the next verse, Jehoiada grew old and he was full of days and he died and he was 130 years old. Not bad, huh? And they buried Jehoiada in the place where they bury the kings of David. He got into Arlington National Cemetery. Why? Because he was a great man. He saved the kingdom. He saved the king. And so he's buried with the kings. Honored. Man of valor. Wonderful man. Godly man. But yet a political man too, because he saved the little king. Well, the next verse says that after the death of Jehoiada, the leaders of Israel, or leaders of Judah come, they bow down to the king, and therefore they talk him into this, and therefore he left the house of the Lord. And he left off worshiping the God of his fathers, and he served wooden images, and the wrath of God came upon the house. Ah, not bother you? So you kind of knew it. You kind of like, he played a religious game because of Jehoiada, but it really wasn't inside of him, you know? It was religion. It wasn't really, you know? And it happens, right? I mean, this happens. People switch, right? We understand this. That's not why I'm telling the story. This is why I'm telling the story. God sends this king, Joash, prophets. Repent. Don't do this. He won't do it. So God finally touches the heart of Jehoiakim, the high priest's son. Jehoiada's son, his name is Zechariah. He touches the heart of Zechariah, who is Jehoiada's son, and he says, "You go confront the king." Now, why would he pick the son of Jehoiada, Zechariah, to go do that? Why? What's he hoping? There's a little memory, affection, admiration, gratitude. There's something alive in this kid's heart that says, "Well, you know, this is the son of the man who saved my life." And so you understand why God would touch this man's life and say, go talk to the king. And so he does. He goes to the king. He says, you've got to stop doing this. It's wrong. Repent. Come back. Zechariah goes back to the temple. Joash calls these new friends of his, and they conspire, and they go and they stone Zechariah in the courtyard of the temple. Now, you don't do that. That's wrong. I mean, go find a drug dealer. And say, hey, I got a story for you. What do you think? Right or wrong? What are they going to tell you? You don't do that. You don't kill the Son of Man who saved your life. That's awful. You don't do that. I mean, you know, go ask a sex offender. What do you think of this story? Right or wrong? They'll tell you. Everybody knows. You don't do that. What bothers me is somebody who plays religion can all of a sudden become this monster. That's what bothers me. Switching religions, well, I understand that. But monsters, I don't understand that. But then Jesus is going to apply this story in a sermon that he preaches in the book of Matthew. Would you like to guess to whom he applies the sermon? What kind of people do you think he applies the sermon to? Yeah, the Pharisees. Look what he says, Matthew 23. Really amazing way he uses the story. He says in verse 29, woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, because you build the tombs of the prophets and adorn the monuments of the righteous. And you say, if we had lived in the days of our fathers, we would not have been partakers with them in the blood of the prophets. Not us. We wouldn't have done that. We're better than that. Therefore, you are witnesses against yourselves that you are the sons of those who murder the prophets. Fill up the measure of your father's guilt. Serpents, brood of vipers, how can you escape the condemnation of hell? Not nice words here. Therefore, indeed, I send you the prophets, the wise men, the scribes, and some of them you will kill and crucify. Some you will scourge in the synagogues and persecute from the city, that on you may come all the righteous blood shed on the earth, from the blood of righteous Abel to the blood of Zechariah, son of Berechiah, whom you murdered between the temple and the altar. Assuredly, I say to you, all these things will come upon this generation. Do you hear that? You killed Zechariah. What do you mean, Lord? It's your kind of people who commit these atrocities. It's the religious kind of people who on the outside claim to be followers of God, but inwardly they are hateful people. And you know what? Jesus' prophecy comes true because they killed Messiah. They not only killed the prophets, they killed the prophet, the Word who became flesh. Now, let me tell you what it is in Matthew 7 that the people are astonished about. Nobody has ever said this in the history of the world. Nobody ever will, only Jesus. Most people say, yes, and you and I are in the same category, yes, there are what we call Christians, and then, yeah, there are religious people. And you know, religious people do some good things too. They're just a little mistaken. Jesus comes along and he says, let me tell you something. There's Christians and then there are religious. And the religious are evil people who destroy and murder and do awful, wicked things. Religion is horrible. How dare you even contemplate being religious? It is a Christian you need to be. You don't believe me? Look at Matthew, verse 15. Beware of false prophets who come to you in sheep's clothing. They what? They look like Christians. They claim to be Christians, right? But inwardly, they're just mistaken. Inwardly, they're wrong. Inwardly, they're empty. Inwardly, they're just seeking for significance. No, inwardly, they're what? Ravenous wolves. They got blood dripping from their fangs. Do you and I look at religion that way? Do we? This is what astonished them. They're just like, you've got to be kidding me. Jesus isn't saying, well, you know, all religions are kind of good, but mine's a little better. Jesus is saying, anything but me is awful. Anything but me, you end up being like Joash, and you will do it. I know. I'm kind of going, Jesus, easy. I'd be going, Jesus, come, easy, buddy. You're not going to get elected president in this one. Well, what does he mean? What's he trying to tell us? Well, let's look at this chapter a little bit. He gives us in here two illustrations. Okay? He's going to give us an illustration of a tree, an illustration of a house. And here's the hard part about it. Jesus is telling us in these illustrations that outwardly, quite frankly, outwardly, there's not much difference. Outwardly, they look very similar. For example, he says there's two kinds of trees, right? Both bear what? Yeah, if Jesus said to me, here's this tree, it's green, it's lush, it's big, it's got all kinds of plump fruit. Here's this tree, it's shriveled, it's drying up, there's no fruit. I'd go, yeah, that's the false prophet and that's the real one. But he doesn't. He says there's two trees with both the fruit. You say, well, how in the world do you know which is which? And the answer is, by the fruit. If you eat this fruit, you live. You eat this fruit, it's poison. You walk through the woods, and there's a nice bush with berries on it. And you go, oh, berries. Now, are these the ones that kill you, or are these the ones that are good for you? That's the point. It's going to take some real discernment to figure out which berry is which, isn't it? It's like mushrooms. I love mushrooms. Be very careful. I don't pick mushrooms. I don't know which are the good and the bad. And Jesus is saying, you'll know them by their fruit. Because if you eat of their fruit, you will be killed. It will destroy your life. But it's going to be kind of hard to tell from the outside, isn't it? Two houses. One is built on sand. One is built on a rock. Let me ask you a question. If you look at the two houses, how do you know which one's built on sand, which one's built on rock? Can you tell by looking at the outside? Huh? No. I mean, someday. See, here's Joash. He looked good, didn't he? He looked good. Problem is, the foundation was rotten. So Jesus is giving us these two illustrations, and he's saying, outwardly, they look alike. But boy, on the inside, there's fruit that will kill. On the inside, there's a foundation that will crumble one day. See, he even in verse 21 says that these people will come and say to him, Lord, Lord. You know what that means? Using the name of God twice is a sign of affection. Abraham, Abraham. Lord, Lord. And they will claim to have prophesied in his name. They will claim to have done miracles in his name. They went to church. They served. They did great things. And you know, Jesus never refutes that. He never says, no, you didn't. He says, yeah, you did. So on the outside, they do some of the same things that Christians do. But there's something very wrong on the inside. And my question is, how in the world do we tell the difference between Christianity and religion, if outwardly it's going to look the same in many ways, but the end result is going to be either something wonderful or something deadly? Well, remember, this is the capstone on the Sermon on the Mount. And so we have to ask the question, does Jesus give us any insight into what religion looks like versus Christianity? And the answer is yes, he does. In chapter 6, he says this. Do you know that religious people pray? They pray. And Jesus says, what? Don't you pray like this. Remember that? Why did he say religious people pray? Well, religious people, according to chapter 6, verse 2, they pray in church. Why do they pray in church? Because you can be seen in church. They pray on the street corners. Why? Because people see them. This is what it says. Ooh, I love this. This is just, Jesus is so good. He says, they pray in the synagogues, they pray in the street corners, that they may have glory from men. You know what the word glory means? The word glory means weightiness, heaviness. That men may look upon them as people of substance. Oh, you must be somebody because you pray in public. You must be spiritual. You must have an importance, a weightiness about you. You must have value. You must matter. You must be significant. Jesus says that these people are trying to fill their soul with their outward deeds, but they have no inner glory whatsoever. They're houses that look great on the outside, but underneath it is just crumbling foundations. They are trees that have beautiful fruit, but the inside is producing poison. Jesus says, don't you pray like that. You go in a closet and you pray in secret. Did you know that these people give alms to the poor? Oh, yeah. They give a lot of money to the poor. And Jesus says, don't you give to the poor like that. Why? Because they love to give the show of giving in the very public ways. Why? Because they want people to look and say, "Oh, you're something. Oh, you're really, I mean, you give money to the poor. Oh, so convicted." That's what they want. They're filling their soul with significance. They're doing external things, but the internal motive is always me. And Jesus says, when you give alms, you don't let the right hand know what the left hand is doing. See, we struggle with this alms and legs because we have a ministry to the poor and we want to stand up and go, "Isn't this great?" And we can't because then we're religious. We have to do goodness for goodness sake because He's good. You understand? And so there's times when we want to say to you, "Praise God with us that He's allowing us to be used," but at the same time we're being very careful because we don't blow trumpets. Because religion's awful. It's awful. He says, religious people fast. Oh, they fast. And they disfigure their faces. They kind of, you know, take the hair, you know, and they, "Oh, this fasting is getting to me." "Oh, you're fasting? Oh, you must be really something to fast. I can't fast. Oh, you must be so spiritual." Not that you mention it. You just don't do that. When you fast, you know, put your makeup on, comb your hair, smile. What's he saying here? He's saying religious people are doing external things, but it's always to meet the internal need of the soul. Religion's always outside in. You do outside stuff to fill the inside. You know, the problem is, it doesn't work. It can't work. You were created with a void in your soul that only God can fill. And you can stuff into your soul all the religion you want. It will never be enough. It will never satisfy the kind of longing and significance and love that you want to have. And so at some point in your life, you get mad with people because they're surely not complimenting you enough, and they're not oohing and aahing enough, and they're not grateful enough. And then you become, the wolf comes out. And you become very judgmental, and you become heartless and rigid, and you use people. And you become a monster. Jesus says religion will always lead to monsters because, believe me, it will never satisfy your soul. Let me ask the question. How many of you know of somebody who at one time was seemingly in the faith, did religious works, went to church, charity, taught the whole bit, and now they have just gone, and not only have they said no, but they have just gone off the deep end. Let me see your hand. If you don't know anybody, you haven't lived long. And it's not just that they said, "I don't want Christianity." It's that, I mean, they left their wife and their family. I was going through my secretary cleaned out the part of Jay's office where my junk used to be and dumped it in my office. Couldn't tell any difference in my office. But anyways, she said, "Which is this? Which is yours? Which is the church?" And, where, and I was going through this box and I stumbled across a picture of my office mate when I taught in Christian school, a man that I dearly care for, and who at one time he and I went through Malden looking for property to plant a church. And I pulled his picture out and I was like, "Oh." Because John is now married to a man down in Columbia. And he was my office mate and we want to plant a church together. And it's not that he said no to the Lord, it's just that he just went, "Whew, I mean, I surely didn't expect that one." And Jesus is warning us that there is, that the religion leads not in a seeming, "Well, they're good people, they're just misguided." No, religion leads you to become something that's very ugly. You say, "Well, what's a Christian then? What's a Christian?" A Christian is somebody who realizes that because of Christ, God looks on us with glory. Because of Jesus, God looks upon you and me as if we are Christ. And He delights in us in the same way He delights in our Son. And you cannot get any more significant or much more glory than that. Zechariah reminds us that God dances over us. God does a jig when He thinks about you. My daughter has this little thing she does. We'll be in the kitchen sometime, and I'll catch this movement out of the corner of my eye, and she will have like a spoon of peanut butter, and she just ate it, and she's overcome by joy that she's kind of just a little. And you kind of go, and she's smiling, and you know, it hit the spot, you know. Every time she does, I mean, it's cute to watch. It's just this involuntary you. God does that. When you come to His mind, He goes, oh, I just love them. And a Christian is somebody who realizes that there is nothing that I could ever do to improve upon that. And that I am so loved and so cherished and I have such value that now when I give money to the poor, it has nothing to do with me. It's everything about the poor, about them. Because I'm rich. I can't enrich my life any more than it's been enriched by Jesus. And when I love and I have relationships, it is not about what I can get out of it. Oh boy, is that the world we live in? Every relationship is based upon what I can get, and eventually it's destroyed because that person can never satisfy your soul. But when you have relationships now, it is about sharing the love that you have, because there is no relationship that can ever make you feel more loved than Jesus did. And when you go to work, it is no longer about you being significant. It is about you serving people, because you are significant. You are the child of God, joint heirs with Jesus Christ. You can't improve upon that, can you? You see, here's the difference. Religion's outside in. If I do this, then I will have this inside. Christianity is, I have this inside, so therefore I can do this on the outside. Religion is, if I do these things, God will be pleased. Christianity is, God is pleased, so I can do these things. And it's subtle, isn't it? It's so subtle. But Jesus says it is like a subtle turn in the road, but the end result is either poison or life. It is either ravenous wolves or it is sheep that are humble in love with the shepherd. It is huge at the end of the road. It looks good for a while with the foundations rotten. It looks good for a while, but the fruit will kill you. And that's why they're astonished. They are astonished because they realize what Jesus is saying. And they're like, nobody ever talked about religion like this. Let me illustrate this to you. Verse 21 is where Jesus says, not everyone who says, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom. Look at what the people say in verse 22 to the Lord. These are religious people. Look what they say. Look at their argument. Many will say to me in that day, Lord, Lord, have we not prophesied in your name? Let me stop there for a minute. What did they just say? They just said, you should be impressed that I spent my life speaking for you. After all, people were impressed. You should too. Lord, have we not cast out demons in your name? I mean, people were wowed by my casting out demons. You should be too, God. And in your name I have done many wonderful things. Don't you see? The false prophet does to Jesus the same thing he does to the people. I do these things so that you can be impressed and you can put me on a pedestal. And I did them for, and he's telling Jesus, I did them for you. Now you got to be impressed too. And Jesus is not impressed. You know what Jesus says to them? Basically, Jesus says, look, everything you did was for you. It has nothing to do with me. In fact, I don't even know you. You know, we shouldn't be saying, I knew who pastor's preaching about. We should be saying, Lord, is it I? Because the difference between Christianity and religion is about that wide. But the end result is huge. In fact, let me tell you something, ladies and gentlemen. We have much better chance of raising a religious child in the church than we do out there. And my question is, are we religious or are we Christians? And are we raising up a generation of religious people who we're giving better tools to play the game, or are we raising up Christian children? And the answer is, how do we know the difference? I mean, you have to admit that Jesus is saying here there is a significant difference between Christians and religion, don't you? I mean, his whole life, the people he took on were the Pharisees. So we have to wrestle and say, oh, dear God, please don't let me go down that road. So how do we define it? Let me see if I can help you here for a minute. I think the solution is this. Christianity is never about what we have done. It is always about what he did. Look at verse 23. Then I will declare to them, the religious, I never knew you. Depart from me, you who practice lawlessness. This is interesting. You know what the punishment is for being religious? The ultimate punishment is to depart from Jesus. Do you hear what Jesus just said? The worst punishment you could ever have is to have me say to you, depart from me. Because everything your soul ever wanted, all those things you tried to accomplish through your good works and through your casting out demons and through your prayers and through all those things you were looking for really were found in me. And now I'm going to tell you that I, the source of your joy, am kicking you away from me. So that now those people will spend eternity with empty souls and the wolves will come out and there's nobody to destroy but themselves. To be cast away from Jesus is the ultimate punishment. Because it is to be cast away from what all our soul desires. The religious people, their problem was they sought to fill their souls with themselves. They never realized what their soul longed for was Jesus. Until Jesus says, depart from me. And then they had eternity to be empty. And to devour each other. Now, if departing from Jesus is the ultimate punishment, what is the ultimate blessing? What's the ultimate blessing? To have Jesus forever. See, Christianity is about pursuing Him, not a behavior. Do you hear what I just said? Christianity is about pursuing Him, not a behavior. Because when you have Him, the tree brings fruit to life. When you have Him, you have a foundation that's strong and you won't waver. But you can pursue all kinds of behaviors. Ended up with rotten fruit and a bad foundation. So my question is, are we Christians or religious? Which are we? And how do we know that we're raising children that are going to be Christians, not religious? I mean, this is serious. Jesus said, we don't believe him, okay? But he said, the prostitutes and the sinners will go in before you will. In other words, religious people are farther from him than the sinners. Why? Because in religion, the lines become very blurred. Because we're good people, we do good things, and we serve, and we pray, and we give alms. And uh-oh. How do we know we're not doing that? Let me read you a quote from Lewis. See if he can help us give us insight. By the way, if you're sleeping, you have to wake up for Lewis, because you can't, you know, Lewis, you can't understand Lewis in the Twilight Zone. This is When I Don't Desire God by John Piper. Kurt let me this. I tease Kurt that he loves John Piper too much, but that's okay. Yeah, you could love worse. Piper quotes Lewis, and he says this. Listen, get this. He says, pleasures are shafts of glory as it strikes our sensibilities. What he means by that is every pleasure is a little shaft of God's glory. It's a little taste of him. He says, but aren't there bad, unlawful pleasures? Certainly there are. But in calling them bad pleasures, I take it we are using a kind of shorthand. We mean pleasures snatched by unlawful acts. It is the stealing of the apples that is bad, not the sweetness of the apple. The sweetness is still a beam from glory. I have tried since to make every pleasure into a channel of adoration. I don't mean simply by giving thanks for it. One must, of course, give thanks, but I meant something different. Gratitude exclaims, very properly, how good of God to give me this. Adoration says, what must be the quality of the being whose far-off and momentary pleasures are like this? One's mind runs back up the sunbeam to the sun. Being a Christian is when you pursue a person in every pleasure. being a Christian is when you are involved in a relationship with your spouse and you have incredible intimacy and pleasure and you tell your children, Mommy and Daddy's love is wonderful, but what Mommy and Daddy's love is teaching us is that what we really want is Jesus. Because this is just a taste of Him. And your kids are going, oh, so love is a taste of Jesus. Love in itself is not the goal. Knowing Jesus is the goal, and that's how love is expressed. And when you go to work and you do something significant and you get a raise and a promotion and you come home and your kids are looking at you, you say, you know, the feeling that I get from doing a great job reminds me that the significance I really want is Jesus. That's what I really want. The promotion's nice, and but it's Jesus. The pleasure I feel is Jesus. That's what it's all about. When you do some great work of art and people are oohing and aahing at the beauty, you say, look, this beauty is just a little glimpse of Jesus. The real beauty is Jesus. This just helps me understand how beautiful, because if I can paint like that, just think what the Creator's like. And so the whole pursuit of the Christian life becomes pursuing Christ in everything. That becomes Christianity. And you know something? The fruits follow, don't they? The fruit of that kind of life is splendor and wonderful and draws people. Religion will kill. See, how are we raising our kids? Are we raising our kids by giving them tools to make them better religious players? Are we giving them the tools to long for Jesus? See, when your teenage child comes home and it's the hormone time, remember that? Okay, that's of God too, by the way. Yes, it's of God. And they're going through this, they're wondering this new world of splendor and love and this feeling and the pitter-patter. Do we sit down and we say to them, okay, here are the rules. Here's what it means to be pure. Here's what you don't do. Which at some point probably is a good conversation to have. Yeah. But it's the first conversation to say to them, you know that feeling you get in your heart and you feel, what you really want is Jesus. Because I hate to tell you, but nobody's going to satisfy that except Jesus. Now, as you have proper relationships and build good friendships and eventually get married, yes, marriage is a taste of heaven, but it is Jesus you want. My son and my daughter, do not waste your life looking for love in the wrong places. You want Christ. He's the one that satisfies Mommy and Daddy. So that your kids are growing up to be Christians who are looking for Jesus, not who have rules to make them look good so people go, oh, you're moral. When your kids come home with their report cards, and of course every parent prays for a normal average kid until they're born, then average is never good enough for any of us. Our kid's got to have straight A's and he's got to score the winning goal too. But when you're talking to your kids, you give them these, do your best, and you need to glorify God by, you know, your performances. Or do we say to our kids, when you work real hard and you get an A on the test and you get an A on the report card and the teacher pats you on the back, you know that feeling that just goes, ah, I feel so significant? Let me tell you something, what you really want is Jesus. I'm sorry, there will never be enough A's in the world to make you significant, but Jesus will. When you score the winning goal and they carry you off and you feel like $1 million, it's Jesus you want. Because He's the one that will make you feel like $1 million forever. Yes, continue your search of excellence, but in your excellence, that's a sunbeam that leads you back to the sun. Follow it back to the sun. Do not become those who are pleasure seekers apart from God. Find every pleasure in God. That's the difference. And one creates ravenous wolves that will do awful things and whose fruit will poison. The other will create incredible people who spread love and joy and Jesus and religion and will draw people to the sun. That's the difference. And even in giving you these illustrations, it's so hard, isn't it? Because the difference is so small, at least at the beginning. But in the end, the differences are huge. So here's what I'm asking you to do. I'm really asking you to go home and read this and say, Lord, is it me? And I wish Jesus wasn't so personal, talking about preaching in my name. All week long, I'm going, okay, is this me? Is it me? I do get a joy from preaching to you. But is that my life? If it is, I'm just religious. And Jesus is not impressed. And he's not impressed with your good works either, unless those good works are an expression of the fact that you are so in love with him and overjoyed by him that he is your joy, and this is simply something you do because of him. So ask the question, is it I, Lord? Am I religious or am I a Christian? And then ask the question, how are we promoting in our home Christianity? So that our kids don't grow up under a moral system like Joash, and who for a time look spiritual, but in the end are a wreck. In the end, they've fallen away and they are trees with horrible fruit because it was religion. It wasn't Christianity. Let's pray. Father, I'm not even sure how to apply this. All I know is that you were passionate about it. You left the people of your day astonished. They got it. They saw it. And yet there's a part of every one of our hearts that is so religious. We so badly want to demonstrate that we are good enough. There's within each one of our hearts this longing to fill that void. And Lord, it cannot be filled apart from you. Oh, dear God, cause us to be in love with you. Cause us to look at our own hearts, and even in the deceitfulness of our hearts, may your Spirit reveal to us ways in which we are trying to earn your favor, and may we change and become people who bask in who you are and your love, and therefore perform out of a love and an overflow of your grace. Be our teacher, Lord, because only you can teach this. If you're here today and you're not sure if you're religious or Christian, may I invite you to see one of us? Just to come and say, look, I need you to pray. I need you to listen to my heart. I need you to help me discern whether I'm a Christian or religious. Because sometimes it takes other people to listen and to pray with you and for the Spirit to reveal that. And I just want you to know that if you are, if you're not sure, we'd love to help you. Let's sing together.